The next case on our docket is 823-1024, City of Eden Prairie versus Travis R. Serafin. Our counsel for both parties here for that case?
Judge, I represent Eden Prairie. I'm here.
Okay, thank you. I think they may be coming into the courtroom right now. Good morning. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Wednesday, January 10th, 2024. We have four cases on our oral calendar for today. This is the third one. This is A23-1024, City of Eden Prairie versus Travis R. Serafin. And hopefully I'm pronouncing that name correctly. Counsel for both parties, you will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, starting with appellant. And then 15 minutes by respondent, and then appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you so choose. This is being live streamed, and this is also being recorded. The recording of this oral argument will be available within the next day or two for the parties. Also, when you approach the podium, there is a button below it so you can lower and raise the podium itself, and you can also adjust the microphone so you can we can hear your speaking clearly. Finally, when you approach the podium, please state your name for the record and the party you are representing. With that, counsel, you may proceed.
Your Honors, may it please the court. My name is Eric Schwab, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Mr. Serafin. We're here today to ask the court to reverse the summary disposition motion granted by the administrative law judge in this matter. There are three reasons why the order should be reversed and remanded back for further hearings. However, before we get to that point, I did want to raise a subject matter jurisdiction issue that I discovered as I was reviewing for this case. Your Honors, the subject matter jurisdiction issue is under Minnesota Statute 299A.465, Subdivision 1B2. That statute states that when PARA determines an officer is duty disabled, an employer may initiate a contested case proceeding to review the determination of duty disability.
Is this the fourth issue that you raised in your brief?
Yes, this would be essentially a summary of the fourth issue, but I wanted to be more clear and tactful about it here, Judge.
Okay. Was this issue raised below?
No, the administrative law judge did not address subject matter jurisdiction.
Okay. Was the issue raised to the ALJ?
It was not.
Okay. So is this issue even properly before us then?
Your Honor, case law suggests that subject matter jurisdiction can be raised at any time. Now, the judge in this case has authority under 299A.465. And under that, the judge has the right to review the determination of duty disability. It doesn't grant the judge any additional rights to review any information beyond that.
But is that determination even in dispute? My understanding is the parties are not disputing the underlying duty disability determination. They're only disputing whether or not they need to pay.
That's correct, Judge. They're not disputing the determination, which is
so why... Is that even at issue here, then?
The issue if Mr. Serafin is duty disabled is not at issue.
Okay.
However, that's the only issue the administrative law judge has the authority to determine. Because the statute grants no additional authority to review a contract dispute at the Office of Administrative Hearings under 299A. So the point I'm making is that the judge went beyond the scope and the authority granted by the statute, and it was improper for a judge to make that determination under 299A.
Now, so should the city have then gone to a district court to say you have to enforce the settlement here?
I would say the city would have that option. Additionally, the settlement, the release agreement itself, does note mandatory arbitration. So they could have certainly gone through that process. But the Office of Administrative Hearings is not the proper venue. Now, assuming that there is subject matter jurisdiction in this issue, there are three errors that the judge made. Number one is that the judge determined that the arguments provided were only legal in nature and not factual. This is incorrect. Second, the judge determined, the judge misapplied the summary disposition standard and construed facts against the non-moving party. And number three is that the release agreement itself unambiguously releases claims up to the date of the agreement. However, entitlement to 2998.465 only occurs after PARA makes a duty disability determination, which occurred more than a year after the employment release. So going back to point one, the judge on page six, paragraph two of the order states that all three arguments presented are not arguments of fact, but rather arguments of law and contract interpretation.
And why isn't that the case? Aren't we really talking about an interpretation of the contract?
Well, the Supreme, it's more than just a determination of a contract. It's a waiver of benefits. And the Supreme Court in Carlson v. Dorn determined that the doctrine of waiver is a question of fact. Additionally, because we're talking about a statutory benefit, we have to talk about, did Mr. Serafin knowingly, intelligently, and voluntarily waive his benefits?
So let's look at the contract and see what it says. The contract says, among other things, that, quote, in settlement and consideration for the release of any and all claims, grievances, or complaints, asserted or unasserted, arising out of or relating in any way to Serafin's employment, end quote, that the city will pay Serafin $150,000, which amount is inclusive of all liens, costs, et cetera, and all other benefits which Serafin may be entitled. So it's future-looking language. It's also incredibly broad language. It's talking about benefits. I think your argument, if I understand it correctly, is that the duty disability would have been a benefit, correct?
Duty disability would be a benefit.
Okay. Is there anything ambiguous in any of that language? And I note in your principal brief, you say that the contract is unambiguous. In your reply brief, you seem to take the opposite stance of saying that it is now ambiguous and there's a question of fact. But is there anything ambiguous in any of the language that I have cited so far from it?
I would point to a different part of the agreement. I'd point.
Well, that's not the question. The question is there anything in what I cited to you, anything there ambiguous? Any of that language?
No, in what you cited to me, that was not ambiguous.
Okay.
However, when you look at the remainder of the document, specifically page 3, section 3, part A, where it states, through this release, Serafin extinguishes all causes of action against the city occurring up to the date of this agreement. That would suggest past-looking benefits, not future-looking benefits, which would make sense. The basis for this release was not due to any type of injury or disablement. The purpose for this release was due to a wrongful termination suit.
Okay, wasn't the release, the language, it says arising out of or relating in any way to Serafin's employment. Duty disability, by its very definition, relates to conduct or relates to issues regarding employment, correct?
It would be, yes, they would be related to issues.
Because a duty of disability is defined as a direct result of an injury incurred during or arising out of the performance of the duties that are specific to that position.
Correct.
So why doesn't the language in the release agreement cover duty of disability by its plain language?
I would say there are three reasons why it does not cover it. Number one is to actually waive that benefit. Mr. Serafin would have had to done so knowingly, intelligent.
That's a separate issue, and we can get into that in a little bit.
Okay. The second issue would be that under Dowd, there still had to be contemplations of the parties of the nature and extent of the injury itself. In Dowd and Aronovich, which are two cases I cited in my reply, those were settled specifically for personal injuries. However, the court still determined that the parties made a mutual mistake of fact because they did not contemplate the nature and the severity of the condition. So we're talking about there both needs to be a legal understanding of what benefits may be entitled to, but there also needs to be a medical component using Dowd and Aronovich.
So are you essentially conceding the first point that the language of the release agreement is plain and unambiguous, but it's more really an issue of whether or not there was intent and knowledge, the two components there, to waive those benefits or any claims that, they may have?
To be clear, I'm saying that the unambiguous portion is related to kind of the umbrella itself, the fact that it's related to employment. However, I would say, given that we're talking about areas of past and future benefits, that the scope and the timing of the benefits would be potentially ambiguous. However, in my interpretation, that's not ambiguous. Because when we're talking about past benefits versus future benefits, in the clause you mentioned, it appears that there may be discussion of future benefits. However, on page 3, section 3A, it says occurring up to the date of the agreement, suggestive of only past benefits.
But the beginning language of it talks about that this parties are entering into this agreement for the release of any and all claims, asserted or unasserted. It's the language is incredibly broad. It talks about that the claims are including but not limited to those arising out of employment. I don't understand how. I mean, I understand you're citing to one provision of it, but that's contrary to all of the other broad language. It seems like you're trying to dismiss all the other language that's in there that talks about how broad it is, claims that are asserted, unasserted, known or unknown. Isn't that fairly broad language? Isn't really your better argument whether or not there was knowledge or intent?
I would say both are fairly strong arguments, Judge, but if you'd like to talk about knowledge and intent, we certainly can talk
sure.
about that.
Sure. So for that, my understanding is that the city is arguing that the agreement itself shows a waiver of knowledge by the fact that there's language in there saying, I'm knowingly entering into this agreement, signed it, was represented by counsel, more than one counsel, up to potentially three different attorneys, had 21 days to consider it, also had 15 days to rescind it afterward. Why isn't all that indicative of knowledge and intent?
Knowledge and intent would require that Mr. Serafin not only knew of the statute, the benefits, and contemplated those itself, but would also need to know the extent of the kind of medical condition that he was in, going back to Aronovich and...
Why would he need to know the extent of the medical condition if the language in it says, I'm waiving all claims, all benefits, everything?
Because in both Dowd and Aronovich, they had similar umbrella-type language covering all possibilities, but the parties still needed to contemplate this, needed to come together to make an agreement. The problem is the parties didn't contemplate the severity and the change in the condition here. So we're talking about an agreement that is made after...
Well, I think you're trying to say there's an issue of mutual mistake. I don't think that's applicable here because I don't think the city is arguing that they had any confusion. I think it's more focused on Serafin as to whether or not he understood and had knowledge of and the intent to enter into the agreement and waive any claims regarding duty disability and any benefits under the duty disability claims.
I would say it's both. The city did not have any knowledge of Mr. Serafin's condition at the time of the agreement. So I would say they would be making a mistake of knowing the scope of his medical condition, having no knowledge of it whatsoever.
But there's even a reference to para in the agreement. So it's not like that isn't something that would... How is that unknown then?
The references to para in the agreement are... There are two references. First, the first reference is just simply stating that the employer will no longer pay into para. Para essentially is like Social Security or any other type of retirement benefit. So there's no contemplation of waiving any para benefits there. The second reference...
Well, but it does say any and all benefits are waived as well.
But Mr. Serafin received additional benefits, actually. He was able to receive workers' compensation. This didn't close out every single benefit.
Was that accepted in the agreement?
There's no mention in the record to his workers' compensation agreement. However, we did represent him for his workers' compensation claim, which ultimately did resolve. He was able to bring that. So not all benefits would have been closed out by that release. Additionally, the judge in her order on page 8, when she's discussing Para, the logic that she has is because Para was mentioned twice, that any benefits that flow from Para were contemplated by the parties. But this doesn't make sense. Para was never waived. Mr. Serafin received Para benefits. The city cannot contract around Para. Any benefits Mr. Serafin receives from Para is between him and Para. It would be like saying the employer waived Social Security disability benefits. So the judge makes the analysis that there was a waiver of Para benefits, and therefore there was a waiver of benefits that flowed from Para. And that's just not the case.
But in your brief, you argue that Para reviews claims for duty disability benefits. You actually paraphrase it as a claim.
Yes.
Aren't all claims released? Isn't there a release for any and all claims, asserted or unasserted? And wouldn't this be an unasserted claim, a duty disability claim?
So duty disability is created from entitlement to para-duty disability. Mr. Serafin did not claim or did not litigate any issue to bring forward a healthcare continuation case.
It's an unasserted claim then, right?
I don't believe it's a claim that can be asserted. It's just awarded under 299A after a determination from para.
But it's a claim that he has to bring. He has to bring that claim to para first.
Yes.
Okay, so it's a claim. So why doesn't the release cover that then, if it covers any and all claims?
Your Honor, I'm short on time. Am I okay to answer the question and provide maybe just a quick close?
Absolutely.
Okay. The reason why it wouldn't be included was because they have no right to actually preclude para benefits. Para is an independent agency with their own rules and regulations. It would be like trying to preclude me from being able to access my 401k. So it can't be precluded. And Your Honor, for the reasons we discussed, I would just ask that this court either reverse and remand to the administrative law judge or determine that there is no subject matter jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal after. Counsel for a respondent, you have 15 minutes. And you may begin when you are ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Joe Nyland. I represent the city of Eden Prairie. I think it's important for the court to understand how we got here from a chronological or context position. Serafin's last day on the job was in March of 2018. That was 3 years before the settlement agreement was reached. Any injury that he had to have occurred prior to March of 2018. The arbitration award was in March of 20, and he was represented by his first attorney, Isaac Kaufman. Following the arbitration award, the city filed a motion to vacate it with the district court, and he was represented by his second attorney, Mark Schneider. And then there was the mediation following that, and he was represented by his third attorney, Marshall Tanick. And then on May 21 of 2021, he hired the Mauser firm, who's here today representing him. The Mauser firm specializes in para and personal injuries. If you look at Doc 4, Court of Appeals, page 60, you'll see the retainer agreement that Serafin signed for his personal injuries and for his para benefits 5 days before he signed the settlement agreement. Second thing that happened on May 21 of 2021 was the city signed the settlement agreement, and it was sent over to the Mauser firm. Something else interesting happened before Serafin signed the agreement on May 26th. On May 25, Serafin went to an appointment with Dr. Robert Hoppe. I'm looking at Doc 4, page, Court of Appeals, page 51 and 52. Dr. Hoppe is a psychiatrist. Dr. Hoppe analyzed Serafin for post-traumatic stress disorder. You can read his report. It says that he believes he's suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. And it concludes by saying, this patient is unable to safely perform the normal duties of a police officer at this time. The patient is scheduled to start individual therapy with this clinician on June 21, 2021 at 4 o'clock p.m. This report is the day before Serafin signs the settlement agreement. 4 days after, he hired the Mauser firm that specializes in para and personal injury. And at this point, Your Honor, I need to point out candor with the tribunal category. There's an error in my brief. So my brief at page 4, first paragraph, cites to Doc 7, Court of Appeals, page 171. And it says that the correspondence indicates the date of injury that Serafin submitted to Para was May 26th of 2021, the day that he signed it. Here's the error. That page in Doc 7 page 171 is in fact the letter from Para to the city of Eden Prairie. The error is there was an attachment with this letter. The attachment indicates that Serafin's date of injury was May 26, 2021. That's the citation in my brief. The error is the attachment is not part of the letter. The letter itself is in the record. The attachment that references the date of injury as May 26, 2021 is not in the record. I don't think it needs to be based on Dr. Hoppe's report, based on the retention of counsel. Looking at the Sorensen case, well, first, the law presumes settlement agreements are valid. This is not an ambiguous settlement agreement. There are multiple places in the agreement that the language is clear and unambiguous, as the court pointed out. The first one appears in the recitals. In paragraph F in the recitals, where it says the purpose of this settlement agreement is to put an end and rest to any and all possible disputes between the parties. This, I don't know if the court recalls this case. This was on the front page of the Star Tribune when the Hennepin County attorney and some Hennepin County judges released defendants. There were defendants who were actually in prison that were released because of Serafin's conduct. This was a very high-profile matter that resulted in many criminals, including murderers, being released as a result of Serafin's conduct. The arbitration hearing was very contentious.
How is any of that relevant to the questions that are before us here today?
Right. The relevancy to that is that the city didn't want to have anything else to do with Serafin and use the broadest possible language in this settlement agreement to put an end to any claims that Serafin would have. That's the relevancy of it, is we wanted nothing else to do with Mr. Serafin.
Counsel, how do you respond to the question, what your opposing counsel said, that an employer has no right to preclude para benefits?
We're not trying to preclude him from getting para benefits. We're not going to pay for him. That's a matter between him and para. We're here to say we're not paying that claim.
And so the para benefits then comes out of the city. You would pay for them. Is that considered a para contribution, or is that outside of the scope of that term?
It's akin to a premium payment on an insurance policy. It's a benefit that the city would pay as a premium. We don't want to pay it. We think that this settlement agreement contemplated that benefit. There are a number of other points in the agreement that I want to point out. The court's already identified paragraph one.
Counsel, before we go there, I just want to follow up on Judge Schmidt's question. And let's assume, for the sake of argument, that we agree with you that the contract is unambiguous. But you argue that he's entitled to, you're not contesting he's entitled to benefits, only that the city is not going to pay them.
It's not exactly right.
Okay.
That's between him and para, whether he's entitled to it or not. I'm not saying he's entitled to it. I'm saying that we're not going to pay for it.
Well, I understood your briefing and your position to be that you're not contesting whether or not para's underlying decision is correct.
That's
that
true.
That he's duty disabled.
We are not contesting that.
Okay.
That's between them.
Okay. If the city is refusing to pay those benefits, then, and para says he's entitled to them, how does he get compensated then?
He can pay for them out of the $150,000 that he got. He also, and it's in the record, he already has insurance. That's part of the record already.
Okay, another somewhat related question. Counsel brought up subject matter jurisdiction, that the ALJ had no authority to decide a contract issue. The ALJ only had the authority to decide whether or not he was, whether or not para made the proper decision that he is duty disabled and entitled to benefits, and that the city has to pay them because the city was his employer.
You know, that's an interesting question, and I think the court's correct. It wasn't brought up below, and I didn't recognize it as a subject matter jurisdiction argument in his brief. Evidently, the court did. But the ALJ does have authority over para benefits and who's going to pay for those. So I haven't briefed it. It's not in my briefing. I haven't researched it. But I believe that the ALJ does have authority to determine who is responsible to pay para benefits. A couple of other points on the settlement agreement itself. The court's already identified, well, I talked about recital F. The court's identified paragraph 1 and 1A. Court's identified paragraph 2A and 2B. In paragraph 3, there's some interesting language that has not been talked about. Counsel relies heavily on, through this release, Serafin extinguishes all causes of action against the city occurring up to the date of this agreement. Focus on that language, causes of action. It's not claims, it's not grievances, it's not benefits, it's only causes of action that had accrued up to that point in time. That's the limit on that language. It goes on, and there's a semicolon in here, to include tort claims. Then there's another semicolon, and it goes on to include all claims arising from any federal, state, or municipal law or ordinance. The whole basis for this claim by Serafin is entitlement under PARO, which is a Minnesota statute. and he gave that up. So looking at the Sorenson case, and you know, counsel referred to Dowd. Well, Dowd's interesting because it was a mutual mistake. In fact, it went as far as the judge, the doctor in that case, had essentially absolved the 16-year-old minor of any problem with the aneurysm that ultimately related to his death. So there was a mutual mistake there. There's no mistake here. The city did not want to have anything to do with them. Tort claims, benefits, any claims, any causes of action, we want it out, and that's what the language says. Unless you have anything further, that's all I have to say.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Judge. I just wanted to clear up a little bit of confusion here because we are discussing PARA, we're discussing healthcare continuation. The issue before the administrative law judge was brought under 2998.465. That is healthcare continuation. So I just want to be clear and get on the same page about that, that the hearing itself and the jurisdiction of the hearing for the administrative law judge was all governed by 2998.465. And going back to it, it does say that the review is based on the determination by PARA. It does not provide any other grounds for the judge to review information. Now, you've heard from the city that they are not contesting the determination of PARA. Therefore, there's nothing more that can be done under that statute.
Isn't there a second question, though, of who is going to pay for it? And that if he's determined by PARA to be duty disabled, then who pays for that, that claim?
The statute provides no additional grounds for the scope of what the judge is able to do.
But isn't that part of it? Isn't that part of the issue that needs to be decided?
That issue does need to be decided. However, with the statute, the judge at OAH does not seem to have the jurisdiction to do so. The statute provides the power to the judge in this case. The statute does not provide the judge any ability to review contracts, any ability to review anything outside of was the PARA determination correct or not.
But your opening brief argues that the statutory benefits under 2998.465, the city's contractually barred. I mean, your brief isn't raising the subject matter jurisdiction. It's talking about being contractually barred from initiating litigation. And so that seems to be very different than what you're talking about here today.
I would say it's very much in the same vein, because when we're talking about this agreement, we're talking about parties don't want to necessarily sue each other. Mr. Serafin applied for a PARA duty disability benefit and then was given healthcare entitlement under the statute. He never filed a claim. He never attempted to bring any litigation. Mr. Serafin's not the one that brought the litigation here today.
But you just said that they can't, the ALJ can't even get into the contract, but you argued in your brief that it was contractually barred. That's what the ALJ should have concluded under the statute, which is then getting into the contract.
I would say that what I wanted to express in my brief is that the ALJ can review the contract and should have reviewed and determined that there wasn't subject matter jurisdiction and that they are barred from bringing any claims.
But I did a quick search of the briefs. I did not see the word subject, can't think of the word now, the phrase, subject matter jurisdiction. It's not anywhere in any of the briefing. So this seems to be a completely new issue being raised in oral argument that wasn't even briefed, much less raised to the ALJ to say, wait a minute, you don't even have subject matter jurisdiction to hear this. I'm a little concerned because the reply brief takes a different position than the main brief in terms of ambiguity in the contract. The issue raised that you did raise in there was not raised before the ALJ, and now we're hearing yet a third new issue that is not briefed anywhere.
Subject matter jurisdiction was never waived, and if this court feels that it was not properly addressed by the administrative law judge, I believe the proper thing to do would be to refer it back to the administrative law judge and have that judge make a determination if there is subject matter jurisdiction.
But we don't have any briefing on that issue.
I would say subject matter jurisdiction just was never waived, and it can be brought at any time. And if there is question on it, I think the proper recourse would be to send it back to the lower judge.
I have a couple of other questions for you. My question focuses on the language in paragraph 1A, where it says the city will pay Serafin $150,000, which amount is inclusive of all liens, interest, costs, disbursements, attorney's fees, so on and so forth. It goes on to say para contributions and all other benefits to which Serafin may be entitled. And it's the city's argument, I understand, that to the extent that any additional para benefits are to be awarded to Mr. Serafin, that rightly should come out of the $150,000 lump sum that he was paid in exchange for giving up those benefits and rights. And why isn't that so?
The $150,000 was for an employment dispute. It was for, may I continue? My time's up.
Yes, you may.
Okay. The $150,000 was for an employment dispute. Mr. Serafin was wrongfully terminated, and an arbitrator determined that he was wrongfully terminated. The city wanted to be done with that issue. So that money is not to compensate him for an injury or anything
like
that.
But the release agreement is not limited to wrongful termination.
It is not limited, but it is limited to up through the date of the agreement.
So I want to get a clearer understanding quickly, if I can, about para. So let's say we have a person who has been working with the city, and let's say the city goes bankrupt and there is no money. Where do the para benefits get paid from then?
So para actually has a trust fund that they use to fund out benefit payments. Think of para much in the same way you think of Social Security disability, where yes, employers pay into it, but the benefits administered are by that group.
Okay, and is there anything, any authority that you're relying on that says that a person cannot contract away their power benefits?
I would say there's no privity of contract between the city and the employee to exclude third-party benefits.
Is there any case law to support that proposition?
I do not have any that I can cite right now.
Okay.
Thank you.
See, no other questions. Thank you both for your oral arguments and your briefing. We'll be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory timeframe. Thank you.